Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, today we'll speak with writer Sue Monk Kidd, author of The Secret Life of Bees, about her recent release, The Invention of Wings.
And then, The Power of Grains. We'll explore some gluten-free grains with sisters Patricia Green and Carolyn Hemming, cookbook authors and health experts. They'll introduce you to several grains you perhaps have never heard of.
And then one of my favorite topics, or shall I say one of the most elusive to me topics, willpower. We'll speak with Kelly McGonigal from Stanford University. We'll talk about her popular class called The Science of Willpower and her book that's newly out in paperback. It's called The Willpower Instinct, How Self-Control Works, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do to Get More of It. I kind of have to keep from chuckling as I read that.
We keep returning to Kelly.
Yes.
With her willpower.
I know. It's great. It's good stuff. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Winter is in full swing at the Utah Olympic Park. The park is open daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Explore the Alf Ingen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Olympic Winter Games Museum. Take a guided Olympic heritage tour or watch athletes train while enjoying a hot beverage from the Silver Bean Cafe. Info and rates are available online at utaholympiclegacy.com. Parking and admission is free. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, Sue Monk Kidd is a celebrated writer. Her book, The Secret Life of Bees, went on to be adapted for the big screen in a classic and timeless film. The Mermaid's Chair, her second book, also a literary success. We don't often speak to authors of fiction on this show, but we wanted to talk with Sue Monk Kidd about her creative process and how she treats the seemingly current topic of civil rights and the power of women. Monk Kidd's sweeping new novel is set in motion in early 19th century Charleston. She's inspired by the real life story she uncovered of these two young girls. One is a slave and one is the slave owner's daughter, and how they go through life in various stages of realizing their hopes and dreams and aspirations. And Sue Monk Kidd, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
So The Invention of Wings, it tells the story of two young girls, basically, one a daughter of a wealthy white family, the other a slave. It's set in the early 1800s. These girls, roughly the same age, you follow them for 35 years. And my first question is about the timing between the movie The Butler and 12 Years a Slave. This is a very timely, kind of a revisit into this excerpt of history. I'm wondering why you went there and why it's important.
You know, it's very coincidental, actually, that all of these films and books are coming out about the same time. I think that's actually kind of interesting and fascinating, as if there's something in the cultural air about this. But it certainly wasn't anything planned. I've been working on this book for about 4 years because I was completely captivated by the life of Sarah Grimke, and I wanted to tell her story and rediscover her because she's been kind of lost in American history, and then entwine her life with that of an enslaved woman, so we have the whole spectrum of how that world was.
Let's talk a little bit about, I've read that you found it very intimidating to write from the voice perhaps of a slave, and it was something new for you, maybe a departure for you.
Well, that was very daunting to think about writing in that voice. It's far removed from me in time and place. But what was surprising about it all was that this character of Hetty Handful, the enslaved girl and woman in the story, actually came fairly easily to me. I will say more easily than Sarah's voice. So the novel is actually narrated by these two women in alternating chapters, and their voices, it was important, you know, to get their voices exactly right, and I had not imagined that the enslaved character would talk to me more easily than Sarah.
So in all your works, there seem to be kind of major themes that are consistent and run through them. And one is that you talk about women's issues, obviously. And the other is you grew up in the South, and that seems to inform your themes and your stories. Can you tell us about that?
The motifs of race and gender, which are very strong in this novel, abolition and women's rights, they feel very personal to me. I mean, I grew up in pre-civil rights, pre-feminist America, a child growing up in the 50s in a little town in Georgia, about 3,000 to 4,000 people. And it was a time where there were enormous racial divides, and I witnessed a great many injustices, cruelties. Just, it was part of my history, and it impacted me. And the same was true of women. You know, there was a great many limitations on women, and I think even with vocation, which in the novel, Sarah longs to be the first female lawyer in America. And I could kind of identify with her desire to have a vocation and yet finding that it wasn't one of the traditional ones and wasn't supported. So even then, you know, I think these matters felt kind of personal. So I have been drawn to write about race, race relations, empowering women and girls for a long time.
You know, I'm wondering, Sue, if, and I feel this very much having grown up in the West and the North, that it takes someone from the South to really inform me and educate me about that era, even though, you know, I've been educated about it my whole life. I don't think I understand it like someone like you would. And I also want to say that, you know, you're bringing this excerpt of history back to the next generation, the school children right now. Is that sort of thing on your mind at all as you wrote this book?
Well, it was on my mind that this lost piece of history of Sarah and Angelina Grimke, these first female abolition agents and women's rights pioneers, to bring them back into our public imagination, into our history again, to give them some place back again. And I think it's very important for our children to know of this history and slavery. It was a very formidable thing to write about, to say the least. I mean, I would be up at night worrying about what I was biting off here and taking on. And yet, I don't think as Americans we have fully come to terms and resolved all of that. That's ground zero for racism in our country. It's where it started. And it left us a legacy that we are still grappling with to this day, and which was one of the reasons I wanted to go back to this time and explore the very roots of it and see it in the lives of two people and how it impacts us today.
Sue, you've had great success with your previous books also, The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid's Chair. Is there something that resonates with the way that you write with your audience? Or what do you, obviously there is, but what do you think it is that resonates so well with your audience?
That's such a hard question, I think, for an author to answer because it's part mystery to me. All I know is that I'm trying to tell a story that has power and hope and redemption in it. And to tell a story that resonates with the deepest thing in us, the very deepest, and maybe it has a universality to it. I mean, I imagine these things, but I'm not really sure of the reason. I can only say that as an author, I'm enormously grateful for every reader that I have.
Mm. The Invention of Wings, a novel, is Sue Monk Kidd's newest work, and we're very pleased that you joined us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Sue Monk Kidd with her new book, The Invention of Wings. You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, only on KPCW, only in Park City. We'll be right back.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended 645-6455.
I'm Monica Simos with the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at kpcw.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, and Todd Wakefield, Attorney at Law.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch, a proud supporter of KPCW. We understand the importance of local banking. We offer banking products from checking and savings accounts to business lending. Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch is located at 1225 Deer Valley Drive or online at grandvalleybank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with Tim Henney. Well, you know, we love to talk about competition on this show. We have some competition coming up next week with our pledge drive version of The Mountain Life.
And the Round Valley Roundup. Don't forget that.
Oh, yeah, the Round Valley Roundup coming up a week from this Saturday. And we'll talk a little bit later in the program about the Pledge Drive version of The Mountain Life and Live Well Center, who will be joining us that day. But first, we're going to talk about the Boulder Mountain Tour, which is this year it was a 35-kilometer race set in the beautiful mountains near Ketchum, Idaho. It's a Nordic ski race, skate ski race, and Tim, you and I seem to have a little competition going on.
Go figure.
So last year, for our listeners, a little background, I beat Tim by 20 seconds. It was a big victory for me. I don't think I'd ever beat you before.
Not in the Boulder Mountain Tour. You've beaten me before in other competitive events.
Right, right. So I had a 20-second lead. So, of course, you took it upon yourself to do what this year?
I believe I declared and proclaimed that you would not be beating me again this year. And I focused a little more on the skate skiing. I got out to Round Valley a few more times. And I also kind of tried to pay attention to the waxing a little more than I do sometimes when I do that race. I do have a tendency to throw a layer of wax on, maybe one layer of wax instead of the three, the base, the race layer, and the super fast, high, you know, cost wax at the end.
The jet stream.
I just tend to throw one layer on and go, it's good enough. And oftentimes it's not good enough.
Last year
it wasn't good enough.
Right.
I definitely had slow skis last year. And for me, if I'm not, let's see, there's two parts to it. If I feel like my skis are slow, that's a psychological detriment and it affects me physically. And if my physical fitness isn't at a level where I can push through and overcome that, it becomes a downward spiral. And that's what happened last year.
Yeah. And that shows you that racing is part of it is mental.
Very much.
Certainly.
So.
And last year I had the fastest skis I've ever had.
And that
it
fed
was,
that positive loop, right?
Oh,
you were in
yeah.
that positive loop.
I
Every
passed
time you took
people.
A stride, you felt that speed and momentum and there was no resistance. I love that feeling on skis.
Right. Yeah. And this year I didn't have that. In fact, I didn't pass a single person. So I start up towards the front in I am in the elite wave, but I started up front, never passed a single person, only got past, which, you know, that messes
Again,
with you a little bit.
Psychologically.
Now, I want to just say that, okay, so last year I beat you by 20 seconds.
Right.
This year you beat me by how much?
Well, I thought 6 minutes, but I heard you say just a little while ago 8 minutes. So I'll take either.
But
let's create a range. It was 6 to 8 minutes.
Somewhere in there. In other words, significant.
If I had beaten you by
whooping.
8 minutes, I would have caught you on the trail. So I'm pretty sure it was more like 6.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was somewhere in there. It was significant. And here's what I think, and this is my observation and why we're even talking about this, is what we do with our bodies. This year, I've done only cross-country skiing during the winter. Last year, I was doing CrossFit 3 times a week, so I was getting a more well-rounded, fitness level, and different muscle groups were getting worked. And this year, not only have I noticed that I'm tired all the time, which may or may not be connected to doing only one sport, but I have overuse stuff happening. My hips felt like they were seizing up in the race. And I think it's just from doing too much of one thing. And you, on the other hand, you were doing CrossFit last year. You were also doing CrossFit this year.
I was. And I'm a big believer in cross training, and I think it can only help. And it it's not necessarily CrossFit. It's anything that gets me out of my normal routine and has me using other muscles. I will say one thing I like about CrossFit is I would never lift weights on my own, and that program forces me to lift some weights. And you don't have to lift the prescribed weights, the big weights. You can scale it back and lift, you know, do higher tempo at lower weights. And that tends to be my program because I don't like the big weights. But lifting weights, it all helps. And I think it definitely gives me that cross train aspect. And I didn't have any issues physically out there on the course. It was mental and fitness. And those were okay this year. They weren't great. They weren't the best ever, but no physical overuse issues whatsoever.
Ah, very good. Well, congratulations.
Thank you, Lynn.
And let me add that I contributed to your fast skis. I did
the final layer
for you
as
you were busy with city council retreat. I was up there under the supervision of wax guru Tom Noker, putting that final layer of Jetstream on your skis, making them fast for you. So
And thanks for that supervision, Tom.
Yes.
I hear my skis had a little extra wax on the tip and tail, which was dealt with. So I appreciate that.
Very good. Okay, well, let's welcome our next guest, Kelly McGonigal. Let's see, does willpower elude you? Do you believe that maybe you don't have it? Sometimes I wonder. And if your New Year's resolutions have gone by the wayside, what are the reasons behind that? Willpower, it's something we want more of, but maybe aren't willing to work for. Our next guest, Kelly McGonigal, teaches a class at Stanford University. It's called The Science of Willpower. Not surprisingly, it's a very popular class. We spoke with her when her book first came out, I think last year or the year before, but now it's been released in paperback. And we thought we'd talk to her again. It's The Willpower Instinct, How Self-Control Works, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do to Get More of It. And Kelly McGonigal, thanks for joining us here on The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
You teach this course about willpower and the science of willpower at Stanford University. And Tim and I have long been fascinated by what goes on at Stanford University and sort of this realm, all kinds of curious things that you wouldn't think there'd be a course on. But why do you teach a course on willpower? Why is it such a big topic that even brings in neuroscience, for example?
Well, you know, I was really getting frustrated hearing from people, both undergraduates at Stanford and people in the community, saying things like, I have all of these goals, but I just don't have the willpower to reach them. I have these changes I want to make, but I don't have any willpower. And that frustrated me because the science was pretty clear that everyone has willpower, just like everyone struggles with willpower challenges. And it's better to think of willpower as a strength that can be trained rather than a personality trait that you lack. So I decided to teach a class that actually inspires people to understand that willpower is something that they can develop and to actually create a course that would allow people to choose a goal and then apply the science to reaching that goal.
Kelly, it seems like willpower is not a new concept. It's been around forever, right? I mean, human beings have always had willpower. So why now is there the need to figure out how to connect our goals to achieving them through the development of this trait that we all share called willpower?
Well, it's true that we've been talking about willpower for a long time because it's fundamentally human to struggle between making choices that feel good now and choices that will pay off later. And I think one of the reasons why it's really helpful to think about willpower now is that we live in a society that is kind of designed to push us towards the self who makes choices based on the present moment rather than the future, whether it's all of the distractions of technology, the stress that we experience, being sleep deprived, having so many temptations in our environment, you know, how readily available food is. All of these are things that push us to being the more impulsive and gratification-seeking version of ourselves. And so we need to counter that a little bit by beefing up and training that other part of us who makes long-term choices.
But Kelly, isn't that kind of running counter to the belief of being here now? In the present moment and living a fully expressed present moment?
You know, it's interesting. When you are really in the present moment and mindful, you tend to have a point of view that is pretty expansive and actually really understands that what you do now is going to have an effect on your future health and happiness. And really being in the present means being able to hold those opposites at once. You know, not trying to deprive yourself of pleasure and meaning now, but also not creating problems for yourself that at some moment that feels like now, it's going to be now when it happens, that you're going to end up really regretting and having to live with the consequences of that. So I think living in the now is a great way to think about it if you're actually practicing mindfulness, which means being able to balance these two aspects of ourselves.
So Kelly, it strikes me that what you're teaching at Stanford, you know, you have to conform to a kind of traditional consensual reality of here's how we teach people and here's what a course looks like. But you step, and I can hear it in the vernacular that you're using, a bit into the woo-woo side of things. How do you reconcile those two?
That's funny. Yeah, people get scared sometimes to talk about, for example, meditation as brain training. That can seem very woo-woo, when actually it's just thinking of the brain in terms of a muscle that needs to be fit and exercised. And I think it's one of the reasons why I draw on science. If there's research suggesting that something helps, then I want to support it. And it's not just the woo-woo, it's also things like faith, which really can strengthen our ability to make change and be our best selves. And science actually supports things that people might not typically associate with science. And I'm all for, you know, making your life a science project and experimenting with things and finding out if they actually help you.
You know, I find it to be more appealing to look at willpower as this scientific thing than just a simple decision. And we spoke with, I don't know if you're familiar with the Younger Next Year and Thinner This Year books, but we spoke with the authors of that book, and they talked about willpower a bit as just being a simple choice. You just decide to do it, and then it's done, which is so simplistic, but that is the sort of the psychology behind willpower. But what about the biological functions that you talk about that influence our self-control?
It's funny. So willpower is a choice. You just make it. But unfortunately, you have to keep making it. That's, you know, one of the reasons we need willpower is because every choice we make has the possibility to impact our goals. And one of the things that can influence whether or not we're able to make those choices is our biology. You know, to be the best version of ourselves, our brain and our body need to be in a state that looks kind of like the opposite of stress, the opposite of fight or flight. Sometimes psychologists call it the pause and plan, mind-body response. And so when you take good care of your biology, say by getting enough sleep, it actually puts the brain and body in a state where you're more likely to remember your goals and you're more likely to have self-control and motivation. So it's not just a kind of, you know, how you think about things, but also how you're taking care of your brain and your body.
That is so right. I mean, I've made some New Year's resolutions, I admit. Okay, one of those is no alcohol for the month of January, which, you know, isn't really that hard. But, I mean, it is funny that I've thought, well, you know, I'm going to have to do a few things, and one of those is get a good night of sleep. I don't know how that ties in, but it does, because it just makes you feel somehow like you are in control, and then you can be in control of the situations that, you know, when it's difficult.
Yeah, and it doesn't just make you feel like you're more in control. It actually facilitates the brain's ability to give you self-control. And when you're sleep-deprived, it actually kind of shuts down those systems of the brain. It's, you know, self-care is such an important foundation for self-control. And sometimes when we're trying to make a change, we actually sacrifice and skimp on the self-care side. And that's a mistake.
So, Kelly, something that you say is giving up control. And since we're talking about control, how is giving up control sometimes the only way to gain self-control?
Well, too often when people want to make a change, they try to control the things that are not possible to really control, such as their thoughts and their feelings or their cravings. They might think, I'll quit smoking when I no longer crave a cigarette, or I'll do this thing I'm procrastinating when I no longer feel anxiety about it. And they may spend all their energy trying to suppress those thoughts, or those feelings, or those cravings, which tends to backfire and actually make us think it and feel it and want it more. The more we say, I'm just not going to think about that, the more obsessed we get. The more we say, I can't feel this way, the more it takes over. And so you kind of have to give up control of those things and accept that you may need to make choices and do things even when anxiety is present, even when a craving is present, and to trust that you have the strength to make the change before the inner experiences change. They're often the last thing that changes.
So there's a little bit of an embracing the things that you can't control, because if you repress them, they come back at you and create problems. And by acknowledging that they're there and embracing them, it actually opens you up to the things that you can control through willpower?
Absolutely. And it's a bit of a paradox. The more you accept a thought or a feeling or a craving, actually the weaker it gets. But it's counterintuitive to most people. But there's lots of research saying, you know, if you accept your cravings, they end up having less power over you, especially compared to trying to repress your cravings.
So, Kelly, I'm wondering, what has been the biggest aha moment as you teach this course? What is the biggest thing about willpower that the students have said, okay, that is my key, and that's the clue to it?
I think that the thing over the years that I've gotten the most initial resistance to and then becomes an aha moment is the idea that self-criticism is not motivating. Mm. And so many of us use self-criticism to try to inspire change, when actually it tends to make us feel so bad about ourselves that we give up on our goals. This is especially true after a setback. And I've heard from so many people initially, they say things like, well, I'm not hard enough on myself. That's why I can't change, and that's why I have no willpower. Mm. When in fact, actually believing in your ability to change is much more important than self-criticism. And having compassion for yourself when you make a mistake, forgiving yourself, is much more likely to give you willpower than guilt or shame.
Ah, that's good. Okay, so help us reframe. Say I was going to run 25 miles a week, and I, in the first week, only ran 5. How do I reshape that?
First of all, you should celebrate the fact that you did something that was consistent with your goals. And I always tell people the biggest thing is to flip the switch from doing nothing to doing something. And as soon as you've tried, you flip the switch, which means you are on the path that you need to be on, even if part of that involves a setback. Hmm. And the other thing is to reconnect with your want power, the motivation behind this willpower change, and to remember why it is that you thought you wanted to run for 25 miles a week, and allow that to encourage you to say, all right, I did 5 miles, and that's a lot better than doing nothing, and I'm going to remember the motivation so that I'm willing to get up and go for a run tomorrow, even if I don't have the time to do the full run that I might idealize.
That's good. Any other takeaways that you'd love our listeners to hear?
I think, you know, the other biggest aha is the recognition that self-control requires social support. And, you know, this is true for parents thinking about trying to instill self-control in their kids. The biggest predictor of kids' ability to develop self-control is how much trust they feel for their parents, not how much their parents have disciplined them. And as adults, we need to seek that kind of trust and social support ourselves, to find communities that care about us and will help us reach our goals. It's a mistake to try to think that willpower is all about doing it on your own.
Our guest is Kelly McGonigal, and her book is The Willpower Instinct, How Self-Control Works, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do to Get More of It. And it's a pleasure to talk to you again, Kelly. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Again, that was Kelly McGonigal, Stanford University, and the science, or the willpower instinct, how self-control works, why it matters, and what you can do to get more of it. And I can't help but say that it's made me think of Philip Seymour Hoffman, 23 years sober before going back. Of course, willpower and addiction, fighting addiction, are two completely different things, right?
Well, yeah, I think they're two different things, but I think they each inform the other. So, you know, they play a role.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, but willpower in the good sense of things. You must have done something that required willpower recently.
Yes, I have done some things that have required willpower.
Not to put you on the spot.
Well, you know, my green glowing smoothie, I'm consecutive days approaching 1 year. How about that?
That's impressive. Every single day of the last year.
Every single day. And I mean, mm-hmm. that's required me to actually bring my blender to places that I've traveled to, you know, not knowing if there would be a blender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's...
That's just plain
that's
crazy.
Well, I thought it was willpower.
No, it's willpower. It's good. And I can see the difference in you.
So
yeah.
Willpower in a good way is just plain crazy. thanks for telling me now.
You have been... transformed by the green glowing smoothie.
You think?
Yeah, I do.
Well,
Plus, he used to be a little chubby. Just kidding. Tim Henney was never chubby. All right. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back to talk about ancient grains with the power of grains. A very interesting conversation with two gals, sisters who are nutritionists, and they have written a great cookbook. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law. LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Looking to jazz up your Sunday evenings? Well, listen to the Utah Jazz 180 with me, Mitch Echo, every Sunday at 6:06 after NPR News for the latest Utah jazz news and information.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, next week is the Valentine's Pledge Drive here at KPCW. Of course, always asking for your support of public radio and the programs we bring you. The Mountain Life, of course, being one of those. And we hope that all of our listeners will call in their pledge of support next Wednesday during this hour. And again, in the spirit of competition, we like to try to get more calls during that hour than the other public affairs shows receive. Yes.
Yes, we do.
We do. And we'll also be joined by the Live Well Center and the folks at Park City Medical Center. They're one of our underwriters on the program here. So this week, we decided that we would go in and get a healthy lifestyle evaluation at the Live Well Center. And
I've had my blood drawn already.
You've had your blood drawn already.
Yes, I did that.
And I'm going in tomorrow for that.
So I wouldn't have to fast.
I know.
For more than a night. I didn't want to wake up and fast all morning until we went in on Thursday. So
I know. Even going the first hour of the morning for me without coffee is kind of difficult. Willpower. So we'll be going in for the healthy lifestyle evaluation that they give at the Live Well Center. And then next week during the show, they will present the findings. And this is all part of our little healthy competition we have going between you and me. And we'll see are they going to talk about lipids and our cholesterol and all that on air? It's going to be so exposing.
Well, they did take blood, so I would assume that they are going to talk about those things.
I like that. I thought that they were...
If I just gave blood for nothing, I'm going to be really upset. I'm not a fan of giving blood.
So the things that they test are strength and flexibility, body composition, blood work analysis, individual counseling to support your optimal well-being is one of the things they do there. There's also a cardiopulmonary assessment. They'll look at your blood. They help you just assess what types of lifestyle choices that we all make, whether it's with sleep, stress, weight management, nutrition, joint health. I'd like to talk about joint health after my hips hurting so badly during that race.
Stress and sleep. I think those are two connected issues, and they connect them and talk about those.
Right. Yeah. Right. So tune in to The Mountain Life next week, Wednesday at 9 a.m., of course, and we'll talk to those folks about our healthy lifestyle evaluation. Are they really going to give my body fat composition on air? Whatever. It's fine.
Yeah, I don't think you have to worry about that.
I don't
I'm the chubby
so.
One, remember?
Right. And when they say that you have 6% body fat, our listeners will know that you, in fact, were never chubby, not a day in your life. Okay, we'll be back after these messages with Grain Power. We're going to talk to a couple of sisters about grains, ancient grains, and how healthful they are. Stay with us.
Welcome to the Groovy Pledge Drive of Love game.
Everyone's a winner when you support KPCW. Call in, make a pledge, and choose a dinner and a theater package, including Squatters, Black Diamond Gymnastics, and the Dodo Restaurant in Salt Lake City.
You too can be a winner when you call in and make your pledge to KPCW during the week of February 10th through the 14th.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club and sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is Park City's in-town private country club, just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
It's The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Weir-Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, by now, most of us have explored to some extent cutting back on gluten. We wonder if it's a trend, but then we think we feel a little better when we do cut back. But what do we substitute for glutinous products, all that wonderful bread and beloved bagels? And how do we mix it all up and why? Are there products out there that are far superior? Is there the perfect food? Full of protein, enzymes, things that enhance energy and stimulate our metabolism. And if we find them, how do we make them taste, you know, edible? Joining us to explore the world of ancient grains are sisters and fellow nutrition buffs and cookbook authors Patricia Green and Carolyn Hemming as they introduce their new book, The Power of Grains. And welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
So, Patricia and Carolyn, why don't we start with talking about ancient grains? You know, we're hearing so much about gluten in the news, and it's everywhere, especially in a healthy community like the one we live in, Park City. But we haven't heard so much about substitutions and how to come up with other healthy alternatives to gluten.
So, for us and for this book, we have chosen ancient grains. And these gluten-free ancient grains, rather, and these ancient grains are really that. They're ancient, so they're unmessed with and not genetically modified. They don't have to be enriched with vitamins and minerals in the lab because they are right from the earth. They're whole foods, superfoods. So tremendous advantage to incorporate into what you're currently eating.
And so I'm wondering how these ancient grains have escaped genetic modification. Everything's genetically modified. We're not eating anything that really that it seems that we ate millennia ago.
Yeah, and it's something, you know, that us as consumers will have to be more vigilant about looking for in what we buy. And because these grains are ancient, they haven't really been commonplace in the grocery store. There are not a lot of competitive markets looking for them, or there have not been in the past. So, you know, a lot of independent growers, smaller companies, we'll probably see in the future as the larger companies are not making a profit off them and they're becoming more and more popular, we may see genetic modification happen in the future. So we'll have to keep our eyes open for that.
And that's something that you just said about how, you know, this is kind of a recent trend. And these grains have been around forever. They're called ancient grains, but they're just hitting kind of pop culture, which for me makes me a little suspicious about a fad component or a fad element. Can you address that?
Yeah, it's a totally natural reaction. And really, I would say that that is a circumstance of the way we've been socialized to eat. What we are currently eating, what really is the traditional North American diet, has largely been manufactured for us by the food industry. And that's the first thing that we have to really recognize. Americans, North Americans, are getting smarter about what they eat and trying to understand where it comes from. You know, in the 60s and the 70s, it was, you know, as Michael Pollan has said, you know, cooking was really related to drudgery. And really something may be better done by a major food processor or somebody else. So now we're learning that it's not, and really we should learn about what we're eating, and it shouldn't come in a box.
And so if we were to go far enough back in time, we would find these ancient grains were the staple food source for all sorts of cultures and peoples.
That's right. They really were. And even if they didn't understand the science behind it, they knew that it made them strong and healthy and live longer and prevent diseases and heal faster. And so we are lucky that these were kept around. They probably have become less familiar and more mysterious because of the way culture happens, you know, religion and wars and things. They determined what people would eat, what would become the commodity, so to speak. So that has really dictated where we've ended up today. And now when we hear about things like ancient grains, we do become suspicious because why haven't we been eating them?
And did that tipping point where our socialization to industrialized food, processed food, did that happen just recently? I mean, is that kind of a 50 years back, or does it go back to the agricultural revolution when people, you know, started putting great plots of land under agricultural production?
Yeah, it goes way back. It goes back so far. I mean, the Spanish, you know, when they were telling the ancient Incas not to eat quinoa, for instance, they were, again, at that point, they were starting to control what people were going to eat. You know, thousands of years ago, really. So it's been in effect for a long time. And I think that the way that, you know, modern North American society has sort of manufactured our eating habits has been fairly recent. You're right.
You know, since you mentioned quinoa, and I would say that quinoa is really the most recognizable, I think, and most widely eaten and maybe even distributed of all of these ancient grains that you have in your book. You know, it's fascinating that it was hidden for so long. Then suddenly there's a huge revolution, a rebirth of this grain. And I've heard interesting things about in Bolivia, you know, now all the quinoa is getting exported to places like Whole Foods and to people like us who shop there. What's your thought on that?
Well, we actually work very closely with industry and with scientists that work exclusively with quinoa. Patricia, for instance, has traveled to Bolivia herself. There is little evidence of the people in Bolivia suffering from this, and they are, in fact, benefiting a great deal from the North American surge and interest in quinoa. So it is doing them a great deal of good.
That's nice to hear. Well, let's delve in a little bit to these grains, and I'm going to just tell you the ones I had never heard of before. Teff. Spelled T-E-F-F. I'd never heard of that. And I'd never heard of kanyewa. That's spelled with a K. So I don't know if those are the grains that are most or the least recognized by the general population.
Well, I guess it depends on who you talk to. But kanyewa is actually a small version of quinoa.
Oh.
It is high in fiber and protein, a little bit higher than regular quinoa. And it has the doesn't have that bitter flavor on it that quinoa might have. So it is a good alternative for anyone who doesn't like quinoa. Quinoa might be a good option. And then you'd mentioned teff, which is from South Africa, or is from Africa. And it is one of the smallest seeds that ancient grains. It is really, it's a little brown seed, and it is eaten by the culture there, and they say that even the runners run, and we know of a lot of these long-distance runners, they run by, you know, they eat teff, and they say that their running is,
they say that their athleticism and their skill and endurance is really enhanced because of teff, and they really attribute it to teff. So there's, again, you know, there's these ancient grains that really, thank goodness, there were folks around who decided to squirrel the seeds into their pockets, despite what might have been going on in the political climate of the times.
And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, Lynn's surprised by some of the things that she found because she didn't recognize them. I was surprised to see oatmeal on there. And I'm like, now, wait a minute, oatmeal? That's an ancient grain that has survived through today and doesn't have gluten and doesn't and you know hasn't been modified to the extent that you can still call it an ancient grain.
Right. Yeah, we're so lucky. I mean, it along with the other ones has just got a genetic makeup that's naturally complex enough that it hasn't warranted it. So again, we're going to have to watch for that in the future, but right now as it stands, we're okay. But yeah, oats, we've eaten a lot of that, and really, it's tremendous, and it's ancient, and it started as a secondary crop, which means it started as a weed where other crops were grown. And so, you know, a lot of these things just come about that way. I think they said the origins of it were small seeds of it were found in a cave somewhere thousands and thousands of years ago. So, again, the origins, a bit of a mystery, but, again, grateful that
somehow they have stood the test of time.
And the other one that kind of struck me, and we don't need to talk about it, was the buckwheat, because I remember in my family when I was young, my dad always made buckwheat pancakes. And there's your picture of buckwheat pancakes on the back cover. And the book, by the way, paging through it, I mean, it is beautifully put together. The photos of your meals are full of color, and I just couldn't help but page through every one and see which one I liked the most. And there were a couple that just jumped out at me because of kind of the different elements and the color that was on the page.
Yeah, we really want to demystify, you know, the sort of the mystery behind ancient grains and show people that you can take the traditional North American diet and swap out some of the less nutritious parts and add ancient grains and still make meals that have fabulous flavor with added nutrition. Because we're hearing Oprah and Dr. Oz tell us we should be eating more ancient grains, but nobody's saying how.
Mm, right. Our guests are Patricia Green and Carolyn Hemming. They're the authors of the book Grain Power, Over 100 Delicious Gluten-Free Ancient Grain and Super Blend Recipes. And while we've been talking to the two of you as though, and you are experts on these grains, yes, the fact is this is a recipe book in addition to a great education about all of these grains. And I've just flipped it open to a page that has quinoa sprouts, which I found, I haven't heard of anyone sprouting quinoa before. So that's interesting. It's a Vietnamese vegetable noodle soup with quinoa sprouts.
Yes. Well, we've really sort of given you a very comprehensive book, and sprouting is one of them because you can sprout several of these ancient grains, and it gives you a fresh added nutrition. And you can put these sprouts in smoothies, on sandwiches. You can put them in salads. And like for your example you gave, it was a soup. And so in addition to sprouting, we've also done microgreens, which is very similar. It's like a small little plant that you can cut off, and you can put those on sandwiches or even in smoothies. It's salads. A lot of people believe that there is a tremendous benefit to eating living enzymes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm curious as to how the two of you were attracted to the ancient grains, because this is the third book that you've done, if I'm not mistaken, Quinoa Revolution and then Quinoa 365, The Everyday Superfood. And now you're expanding into a broader array of ancient grains. But what was it that drew you to these foods?
So really, Grain Power and these ancient grains is an evolution beyond quinoa. So quinoa is fabulous. Here's a few others that are equally fabulous, and find ways to incorporate them, sort of, you know, add a little bit of diversity to your meal planning. And really, for America and North America, really it's important to have that biodiversity and not restrict ourselves to any one, two, or even a small handful of crops. You know, with the looming food crisis you always hear people referring to, it's really important to expand our group of ancient grains and the things that we're eating. So this is part of that.
Mm. I have to, before we let you go, ask the question about the paleo diet. A lot of people are into that, and we've explored it a little bit on this program. But one of the things they say is they're kind of against grains, and it has to do with the processing and the hull. And I'm not sure exactly what, but what's your comment and your answer to that?
Well, there's a lot of pros and there's a lot of cons about the paleo diet. It's a specific diet again. You know, it's a business angle, I suppose, to a certain extent. But as long as you are eating, these ancient grains are not, they are all healthy. They are from the earth. They are natural. Mm-hmm. There is no way to go wrong with that.
And one other controversial element of dieting that we run into from time to time, smoothies. I noticed you had a section on smoothies, and obviously you're incorporating these grains into your smoothies, but do you have any general thoughts on smoothies?
As long as you prepare them in a healthy way, a lot of people find it's the easiest way to get nutrition into their kids, because you can get amazing vitamins and minerals using ancient grains into a smoothie, say with added yogurt and maybe some honey and some fruit. So if you can get all of that nutrition in one meal into your kids,
right,
it's a great option.
And what's the preparing properly? What's the drawback? What's the potential pitfall?
With a smoothie?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are some people that get the idea when they're making a smoothie that they're going to be buying something from a store that says smoothie mix, or it's some, there's something processed in it that they're adding, whether it's a sugar or something that isn't healthy. But when you're making a smoothie out of things that are all natural,
when you're using kale and you're using fruit, you know, you're blending it all up. It's fabulous for your body, and it's actually quicker nutrient delivery if you actually do blend up the kale.
Good.
It's easier for your stomach to absorb and digest.
I'm glad to hear that, because that's my position on it. And we constantly run into a little bit of controversy with that one.
Oh, and there's controversy about all kinds of eating habits, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those people are probably using all kinds of sugar or additives and things like that. So you really have to just know what you're putting in your blender.
Right. I think that's what they were addressing, that all the added sugar and the yogurts and, you know, all that stuff at the place, the retail smoothie shops, I think.
Exactly.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. You know, there's probably going to be a great deal of controversy, you know, in the coming months, in the coming years about gluten-free. And really,
right.
that the foundation for that controversy is that people are not making the right choices when they become gluten-free, and they will be, you know, choosing the box off the shelf that is processed gluten-free food instead of using natural fruits and vegetables and ancient grains, which are from plants, to eat properly.
We're going to let the two of you go. I know you're busy and you have another interview, but before I do, I have to ask a question about oats. Sometimes oats have gluten and sometimes they don't. Is that right?
They sometimes do have gluten, but the only reason why they would is because they're processed in a facility that has gluten. If they're processed in a wheat facility or a barley facility, they may be contaminated with the gluten from them. Or they're grown in a field that may have just grown something that contained gluten. So when you're buying your oats, it's important to look at the bag and make sure that it's certified gluten-free, meaning it has not been grown in a field where other glutinous crops have been grown, and it has not been processed in a facility where the same thing has happened.
That's a great clarification. Thank you. And thank you both for joining us. Our guests are Patricia Green and Carolyn Hemming, and their book is Grain Power, over 100 delicious gluten-free ancient grain and super blend recipes. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Tim. Our pleasure.
Well, that was nice. And I think I know a little bit more about some, you know, some dietary choices that provide a little more variety anyway.
It is an amazingly beautiful and aesthetically pleasing book. It's a nice way to learn about these grains and recipes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And I've already given it out to one of my girlfriends who is, I think she has celiac disease. Or it's not celiac. She's just gluten intolerant. And there are more and more people who are coming up with that. Of course.
And it ties into that whole banana flour that we did last week with David Windsor.
Yeah.
The WeGo.
WeGo.
Which, by the way, I saw.
We do. Gluten-free.
Mm-hmm. Which there was a whole stand and display at the Park City Market.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's thank our underwriters.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Park City Clinic, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and San Francisco Design.
And thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
You're listening to KPCW Park City.